Hello and welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Kavita Akwaye. Demonstrators in Kabul have condemned President Joe Biden's order freeing up around $3.1 billion in Afghan assets held in the U.S. for families of America's 9/11 victims, saying that the money belongs to Afghans. Some of this money has been termed, in terms of the U.S. keeping it, as a form of theft. Others are saying that this money should be given to Afghans. Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at the justification or lack of it from the U.S. on allocating this money to victims of 9/11, and not Afghans, who are facing a humanitarian, not to mention an economic crisis of epic proportions in their country. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of the Spotlight. We have Jim Kavanaugh joining us. He's a writer and blogger at The Polemicist from New York. Also joining us, Brian Terrell, political commentator and peace activist, who joins us from Molloy, Iowa.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. Brian Terrell, let me first start with you. You know, this has been blasted all over the place, especially in social media, about the U.S. decision or the decision by Joe Biden to do this. What is your take on the way that the U.S. went about, the thinking that it went about to make this decision? Because obviously we're looking at the situation in Afghanistan and what the Afghans are dealing with.
Well, it's... It is theft, and it's unspeakably cruel at a time like this, at a time this winter. And it's what's been happening these more than 20 years. Rather than sanctions, the United States ought to be paying reparations if there's any justice. Usually a country that carries on a war of aggression and loses, it has to pay up. And the U.S. should have no say about how that money is to be used. The average age, the median age in Afghanistan now is a few months over 18 years. So more than half the people in Afghanistan were not alive on 9/11. They do not owe any debt to the people who died on that horrible occasion here in the United States on 9/11, 2001. Most Afghans didn't know about the events of 9/11 until the bombs started dropping and the U.S. soldiers occupied. The U.S. supposedly already spent more money on the reconstruction of Afghanistan, and this is from the government's own inspector general, than the entire Marshall Plan that rebuilt Western Europe after World War II. And I visited Afghanistan. I was there, I think, seven times between 2010 and 2019. And over those years, well, there's billions of dollars were being spent on reconstruction, going to U.S. Contractors, going to Afghan oligarchs. I just saw the city, the infrastructure of the city, just decay. With every visit, the city of Kabul was more insecure, was dirtier, was
that's interesting.
Yeah, and so it's 300 million dollars a day spent on the war, not on the reconstruction, but on the war going in Afghanistan,
right.
and these people, the people in Afghanistan, are victims.
You know, that's a good point that I didn't think of, which I will address to you, Jim Kavanaugh, if I can. So our guest there, Brian Terrell, talks about how he has visited Afghanistan. All the money did not show itself on the ground where it should. I'm guessing from schools to hospitals to basic infrastructure, perhaps. And then now you have this incident happen in which you have the U.S. taking half of that money, which is amounts to about $3.1 billion, where you have no money circulating in the country, millions are on the brink of starvation. How did Joe Biden think that this is going to help Afghanistan and to solve its crisis?
Well, he doesn't care whether it's going to help Afghanistan solve its crisis. This is a political stunt for the American political theater. And, you know, it plays well. We're taking care of the families of the 9/11 victims. Look, I lived a half a mile from the Twin Towers on 9/11. You know, I'm all for helping the 9/11 families. The United States doesn't have to take money from Afghanistan to do that. No Afghans were involved in 9/11, even according to the official story. The plot was hatched in Hamburg, Germany. So, you know, to make the Afghans pay for this now, after 20 years of war, in which at least 50,000 more Afghan civilians were killed, you know, this is kind of a gratuitous joke to say the Afghans owe us money for 9/11. And it is a kind of gratuitous cruelty. As Brian said, you know, the money that was poured into Afghanistan didn't help real social development of the Afghan people. It went to the oligarchs and the contractors and the weapons manufacturers. And what's happened, and, you know, there was a crisis, an economic and social crisis in Afghanistan before the United States pulled out. So now they're going to make the Afghan people pay essentially this ridiculous, as Brian said, idea that the Americans go in and make war in a country for 20 years, kill 50,000 civilians, and then say, oh, you got to pay us for that. This is ridiculous. You know, it's kind of absurd. You know, when the United States defeated Nazi Germany, they didn't say, Germans, you have to, they tried that in Versailles, it didn't work very well, you have to pay us. They poured money into the country. And so, you know, they had, not only are they taking this money, but they're imposing sanctions on the government. They just want to punish the Taliban for defeating them. And Biden wants to make political capital in the United States with, look what I'm doing. I'm taking this money from the dirty Taliban to give to good American families who suffered from 9/11. And it's really, unfortunately, it's going to work well in the American theater, I think.
Well, let me ask you if I can. I don't know if you can answer this, Brian Terrell, but talk about this decision to give the money, half of it, to the 9/11 victims and whether it's justified or not. One source, and I'm not too sure, I can't say it's authentic or not, but I'm wondering if you have an idea, said that 9/11 families have been supported financially for 20 years by states, nonprofits, and for this move, it's not right to take away from the mouths of starving Afghan and to give these 9/11 families more money. Again, as our guest there said, there's nothing wrong with giving 9/11 family members money. So I'm wondering if this was indeed something that happened where they were taken care of by states and nonprofits, and whether the decision, did it run for a second in the U.S. mind that 15 of the hijackers were from Saudi Arabia and we should go be asking money from them?
Yeah, it's. I do know some people who were victims of 9/11 who don't feel like they've been compensated enough, and I don't know if they could be. But it's unclear whether this money, just as the half of the money that's going to be supposedly going to help the Afghans, whether it's going to get there or not, and also it's questionable whether this money that's been allocated for the families of the 9/11 victims, whether they're going to get it. And I think about all this money that's been spent. If the United States truly had rebuilt the infrastructure of Afghanistan, if they had actually built the hospitals the United States were billed for, that never existed, where the ground was never broken, if they had built the schools that they said that they built, and that so many Americans feel so proud of ourselves for building, if they had done that, Afghanistan would be a very secure place now, and the region would be much more secure. So this is all, you know, we're really making the world much more dangerous. And I'm glad people are out on the street in Kabul. And I'm tomorrow in many American cities, there's going to be people at American peace movement. People are going to be at federal buildings and other government facilities demanding that this decision be reversed.
Sure.
And people will be calling the White House, and I really hope that that we will rise to that occasion and make these demands.
Well, talk about Afghans. Jim Kavanaugh, one of the Afghans out on the streets, said this, and I'm quoting him. Of course, it's been translated. "I don't think the U.S. has the right to use Afghanistan's money to compensate 9/11 victims. The U.S. had no reason when it attacked us, but a lot of people died in the past 20 years. So it's the U.S. that should compensate us, and they should not spend our money." Does he have a point?
Oh, yes. Look, even Karzai, the American installed president of Afghanistan, said this was an atrocity. You know, again, it's at least 46,000 Afghan civilians were killed for something the Afghans didn't do. And so they've, you know, paid dearly for whatever imaginary crimes the United States wanted to, you know, blame on them rather than the Saudis or the German government, which, you know, harbored Mohammed Atta. So, you know, the idea that now what we have to do is impose sanctions and take away the assets, the currency, the gold of the Afghan government to compensate ourselves for what we've done to the people of Afghanistan. It's certainly, you know, if you could find a better way for the United States to guarantee that Afghanistan is not going to be friendly to it, and guess where it's going to turn? It's not going to turn to the United States. It's going to turn to China for help and assistance, and then they'll be whining about that. So it's a very silly notion in terms of even the geopolitical intelligence of the United States, but it's also, as I say, gratuitously cruel. And it's done for Joe Biden to score political points, which he will score. And, you know, because the Republicans and his opponents would attack him if they gave the money to the Afghan government Afghan people who deserve to have it.
That's unfortunate to look at it that way. But, yeah. Well, Brian Terrell, you said that a lot of the population in Afghanistan is, I think, 18 years old. I'm not too sure what percentage you used.
It's the median age is 18.
Okay. I'm going to build on that. Mm-hmm. I'm going to build on that and come at you using that stat, along with how overall you're looking at about, based on what we have, 24 million people who are suffering from acute hunger. That's 60% of the population, not to mention the drought, not to mention the fact that there's been recently a measles outbreak. So obviously the humanitarian aspect and the economic situation along with this is very dire. Add to that the 18-year-old average age. It sounds like this is perfect breeding ground for terrorists to exploit, which is what we have present currently in Afghanistan in terms of an al-Qaeda presence there with Khorasan. So has the U.S. thought how this can turn out to be a national security threat, maybe towards the U.S., since the U.S. president has decided to withhold this money and give it to 9/11 victims?
Well, I don't think it's in the interest of the arms manufacturers that there be, in the words of the CEO of Raytheon Technologies, that peace is not going to break out anytime soon, as he assured his the investors when Biden pretended he was going to stop arming the Saudis. So they don't want peace to break out. General McChrystal, when he was the head of U.S. forces and NATO forces in Afghanistan under President Obama, was interviewed by Rolling Stone magazine, and he said that with every innocent Afghan who's killed, we create 10 new enemies. So we see that metric on July 29th of this last year, the Ahmadi family who were killed by a drone strike, 10 people killed, 100 new enemies by General McChrystal's count were created that day. And if
100
you are,
what? I'm sorry.
100 new enemies.
Right.
For everyone you kill, any innocent person, the United States creates 10 new enemies for itself. So that's good news if your investments are in Raytheon and in Boeing and in these other arms manufacturers. This is what President Eisenhower warned about in the military-industrial complex back in 1960, the fear that the United States is going to be not making weapons so it can fight wars, but making wars so it could sell weapons. I think we've really come to that, and it's just a harsh reality a peaceful, prosperous Afghanistan that had fair and honest dealings with its neighbors, and its neighbors include Iran and include China and Pakistan. Peace breaking out in Afghanistan would be bad news for the U.S. economy, and so it's when things are so predictable, as you put it, that this is going to be a more breeding ground for more terror. Of course,
that's what happened
will
in
be.
Iraq.
It of course it will be. And if something is that clear, so much to be inevitable, you have to suspect then that it's intentional. And on one level, this really is intentional.
This gratuitous
cruelty is there's a purpose behind it.
Sure. Okay. Well, Jim Kavanaugh, do you agree with that? Which is, if true, that is just, I'm not too sure what words to describe, because we're looking at a country that has been a victim for decades now. And it's just beyond words. And we here in Iran obviously see that, not only because of the close proximity that we have in terms of a neighbor, but also because of the influx of refugees that come into Iran, escaping what has happened there for the past decades. But do you think that is a train of thought that the U.S. perhaps has? And as our guest there mentioned, perhaps the arms manufacturers smiling at the fact that you have an Afghanistan that's in tatters.
Not only arms manufacturers, but, the great geopolitical strategist whose idea was, foment jihadi groups in the Caucasus, in the south of the old Soviet Union. Now foment jihadi groups right next to Iran. They know what's going to happen. They're not that stupid. They look that stupid, but there are people involved in this who know what's going, the inevitable results of this. They're going to create more enemies. You're going to drive people into the hands of ISIS, which is already in Afghanistan, has a presence, and other groups like that have a presence in Afghanistan. From their point of view, not only is it the permanent war, as Orwell and Julian Assange said, the point of the war isn't to end the war. The point of the war is to keep it going forever as this constant stream of profits to the arms manufacturers. But it's also a constant stream of now tension and aggravation and diversion for the countries around Afghanistan that now have to deal with those problems. And that's Iran, it's Russia, et cetera. So they want that tension there, and they want the arms, and they want the chaos, really. This is what the United States has been doing for the last 20 years, is fomenting chaos.
Well, taking a look at the act itself, Brian Terrell, it's basically, I was curious as to see the figure $10 billion also thrown in as to the real figure here held by the central bank, which is said to, once this is held, then the banks within Afghanistan, where they're starving for cash, and it's going to cause Afghan businesses and then to suffer because they don't have the money to then pay out, for example, to the citizens or to business, for example, owners. And, of course, then the access to this money is going to be withheld. And, therefore, you have an economy which, as shattered as it was, is going to just basically have the wind knocked out of it. So this chain of events, is there's no way escaping it. Puts into question the U.S. announcement by Joe Biden that we don't want the Taliban to have access to this money. But it sounds like there's a revenge taking place against the nation of Afghanistan and its people.
These sanctions are not hurting the Taliban. In fact, they are making the Taliban stronger by, as we've mentioned, the demonstrations in Kabul and the hatred toward the United States for this outrageous act. I've also had the opportunity to visit Iraq in 1998 during the sanctions there, and visited the hospitals and the schools, and the sanctions against that country were not hurting the upper crust, the cadres that were running the country. It was hurting the common people. This is something that charity is all very fine, and I think for people who are hungry, if some people do end up getting some food out of this. $3 billion that and such that they're getting. I hope it saves some lives. But But what's demanded is justice. I mean, this is not an act of charity for someone to steal someone's food and then give them a few crumbs. It's not our money. And if the Taliban is not to be trusted, the United States trusted a very, very corrupt government, a narco republic, it's been called, that it put in place and supported with tons of cash for 20 years. The sure. Taliban is not going to be any worse. It isn't our money we shouldn't even be thinking about it. It shouldn't be something that U.S. has any say whatsoever. It's a crime.
Well, Jim Kavanaugh, I'm wondering how the Taliban is going to position itself when it comes to the U.S. You have the spokesman for the Taliban condemning the U.S. for stealing the property of Afghan people, as he stated, posting on social media that the theft of the frozen assets shows the U.S. has degraded to the lowest level in human nature. What kind of reactions will we see from the Taliban? I'm guessing, first of all, that the Afghans are going to really rally perhaps behind the Taliban, because in essence they're seeing this face of the U.S. So that's one of the outcomes here. But regarding the Taliban, what can we see from them?
Well, they'll certainly rally against the United States. And briefly, at least in the short run, they'll rally around the Taliban government. But the Taliban are in a difficult position, and they're economically weak, and they're going to need help. I think what you're going to see from the Taliban, as I suggested, is they're going to have to turn to other people who are capable and willing to help them, you know, in a non-cruel way, in a just respectful, bilateral way. So that's likely to be the neighbors, Iran, Russia, China, Pakistan, you know, and these are the places that they're going to have to look for help in terms of, the Taliban is a governing party that they have to find some help for themselves. So that's what they're likely to do. Politically on the ground, it's going to be anti-American, pro-Taliban. If the Taliban can succeed in getting help from other countries, they will definitely cement their position politically in relation to the masses in Afghanistan. So that's what we're going to see that playing out over the next few months, probably. And because it's an emergency, and they have to get something from somebody. And there aren't 100 actors that can save them. There are 3 or 4 or 5 in the world.
Okay. Unfortunately, I'm only left with about 30 seconds to give to you, Brian Terrell, as the last question here. Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to go after American bashing here, but I'm looking at a social media post where it says, "I can't remember the last time so many people of such vastly different worldviews were so united over a U.S. policy decision on Afghanistan in this case." Do you agree?
I haven't heard that. I'm glad to hear that. I hope that there is universal disdain and protest over this. That truly can't stand. And we are, and the urgency of the situation is, the winters are very, very cold in Afghanistan, and there will be many, many deaths just in the next hours, the next days. This is a matter of utmost urgency.
Okay, thank you very much, Brian Terrell, political commentator and peace activist from Molloy, Iowa. Thank you so much. Jim Kavanaugh, thank you for your contribution. Writer and blogger, The Polemicist from New York. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Ikovit Tahway, entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Dear listeners, hello everyone. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and in this edition, we will try to have a closer look at the 25th chapter, Suratul Furqan. First, let's just listen to the verses we're going to talk about in this program, and we'll be back shortly. So stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَقَدِمْنَا إِلَى مَا عَمِلُوا مِنْ عَمَلٍ فَجَعَلْنَاهُ هَبَاءً مَنْثُورًا
And we will approach what they have done of deeds and make them as dust dispersed.
The 23rd verse of the chapter continues talking about the conditions of the wrongdoer's actions in hereafter. وَقَدِمْنَا إِلَى مَا عَمِلُوا مِنْ عَمَلٍ فَجَعَلْنَاهُ هَبَاءً مَنْثُورًا And we will proceed to what they have done of deeds. So we shall render them as scattered, floating dust. As I said in this noble verse, the conditions of the wrongdoer's actions and hereafter is imagined. It says, وَقَدِمْنَا إِلَى مَا عَمِلُوا مِنْ عَمَلٍ And we will proceed to what they have done of deeds, so we shall render them as scattered floating dust. فَجَعَلْنَاهُ هَبَاءً مَنْثُورًا The Arabic word عَمَل, as Raghib in Mufradat says, in this verse, means every work or job done by intention. But the word fi'l, or verb, is general and is applied to both jobs and works that are done whether intentionally or unintentionally. Also, the Quranic word qadimna, as the beginning of the verse starts saying, وَقَدِمْنَا إِلَى مَا عَمِلُوا We will proceed, is derived from the word qudum, which means to enter or to turn onto something. And here, this word is used for putting emphasis on the matter. That is to say, they have certainly done all their actions intentionally, on purpose, though their deeds are apparently right and good. And thus, for their polytheism and paganism, Allah shall turn unto the work they did and make it scattered motes. فَجَعَلْنَاهُ هَبَاءً مَنْثُورًا The Arabic word haba means fine dust, and the word manthur means scattered. So the Almighty Allah says, فَجَعَلْنَاهُ هَبَاءً مَنْثُورًا We shall turn those deeds of them as scattered floating dust, means they will make nothing of it.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
In narrations, the extension of those whose deeds will be nothing is the persons who perform ritual prayer and fast, but do not refrain from unlawful food. Such people do hate and have enmity against Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam and his followers. By the way, the Arabic word haba, as we translate it into dust, means very tiny particles of dust that cannot be seen in a natural way. You may have experienced some situations that you do not see these tiny particles of dust unless sunlight comes inside a dark room from an opening. It is only in that case that these particles are clear and visible, and you understand that there is something floating in this room. In this way, we can see them. And this sentence shows that their deeds will be so worthless and ineffective that it seems there were not deeds at all. They did not bring anything with them in this world. Though they have tried, they have attempted for many years, but now they look back and they see nothing. What this verse says is like the 18th verse of chapter Ibrahim, where it is said, مَثَلُ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا بِرَبِّهِمْ The example of those who did not believe in their Lord. أَعْمَالُهُمْ كَرَمَادٍ اشْتَدَّتْ بِهِ الرِّيحِ فِي يَوْمٍ عَاسِفٍ Their deeds are as ashes on which the wind blows severely on a stormy day. لَا يَقْدِرُونَ مِمَّا كَسَبُوا عَلَى شَيْءٍ They will not get the benefit of anything they did in the world. ذَلِكَ هُوَ الضَّلَالُ الْبَعِيدِ The Holy Quran says, This is a very threatening warning to us that we should not always be hopeful of our deeds and our actions. Sometimes we might be thinking we are assuming we have something for the next world, but it seems because of some unbeliefs we have nothing. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at
englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye. Things always worked for me. Worry ends when faith begins.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Tens of thousands of people marched nationwide while an estimated 3,000 cars converged in Paris for a freedom convoy emulating the anti-government movement in Ottawa. The convoy was led by France's Yellow Vests, who resumed their Saturday marches in October and also included some of the long-running protesters against a vaccination smart pass so strict it's been called a de facto vaccine mandate. Equally important for protesters was expressing long-running disapproval of President Emmanuel Macron and his right-wing socioeconomic policies.
The price of gas is killing us. It's all become too much for us to accept. If we keep letting things go, where is France going to end up?
France responded by flooding Paris with over 7,000 police, who waged yet another violent crackdown on peaceful protests. Dozens were arrested, hundreds of fines were issued, tear gas was constant on the famed Champs-Élysées Avenue, and cars were impounded.
I came here from Bordeaux. The government responds with violence because they have nothing else to offer. And this is why the French do not understand them. I do not think the French are stupid. They want to understand. All we want is some answers to our many questions on policy.
In order to prevent the Freedom Convoy from implanting itself, the capital was locked down in many areas, something which Paris saw every Saturday for over 6 months in late 2018 and early 2019. Freedom Convoy may have already wrested a concession. The government announced plans to abolish the pass at the end of March. Many called the timing curious, as that would be just before voters first go to the polls on April 10th. Protesters say they expect more attempts at an Ottawa-style freedom convoy, no matter how repressed by the government this one has been. It's possible the French election campaign of 2022 has just begun. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Never has it been so costly for EU citizens to heat their homes, use electricity or drive their vehicles. 40% of the 27 nation bloc's energy supply requirements are imported from Russia. So is Moscow to blame for the EU's current energy crisis? Not according to European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen, speaking in the European Parliament last October.
Gazprom has honoured its long-term contracts with us.
However, last Monday it was claimed Russia has cut gas to the EU and citizens were told plans are in train to offset further suffering.
We're determined to prevent that from happening and to mitigate the impact on energy supplies and prices should Russia choose to cut natural gas supplies to Europe more than it already has.
The fact is, Russia has fulfilled all of its EU gas supply contracts. We've raised this issue with the European Commission.
Is the West using energy as a tool to ramp up tensions with Moscow?
Whether you draw conclusions with wider implications point to additional tensions of a military nature, this is your interpretation. This is not anything that we have said so far.
Political commentators claim the EU's negative Russia strategy is entirely being driven by the US.
They can't have an independent policy. It's a tragedy, I think, because Europeans should have a good relation with Russia. Russia is their neighbour. They share responsibility for the continent, for its future, for its security.
17 billion euro of EU taxpayers' money has been sent to Ukraine since 2014. This despite the European Court of Auditors declaring last September that corruption is rife in the country.
What has been done since September to try and ensure that the 17 billion euro won't be squandered?
If there are shortcomings found and proven, then we are working on removing them and making sure that what we do with Ukraine complies with our rules and with our guidelines.
On the issue of gas, of course, Russia could increase supplies to the EU, but what incentive does it have to do so in the current climate? Observers ask. Russia has the largest natural gas reserves in the world, followed by the Islamic Republic of Iran. Analysts say the EU's access to these markets is being hampered due to influence from the United States, and ultimately it is ordinary citizens who are paying the price. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The images are difficult to look at, but the reality of life for so many people in Bahrain is still one of imprisonment and uncertainty. With a few days shy of the 11-year anniversary of the uprising in Manama and surrounding districts, activists in the UK are marking the occasion. One by one, the speakers took to the podium, erected on the pavement outside the Bahraini embassy in London, with a message of defiance and resistance.
We cannot continue to be controlled and ruled by hereditary dictatorships. That time has finished. It must cease to continue. It must come to an end. That is what our people in Bahrain want to achieve, and inshallah, they will achieve that.
In the decade plus since the revolution, Manama has even managed to export some of its violence.
They are participating and helping in bombing the Yemeni children, the Yemeni women. How can this be justified by the Bahraini regime? They are also, on the other hand, have sold the lands of the Arabs and Muslims in Palestine. They have kneeled to the wishes of the Zionists, the international Zionism.
Bahrain has featured on UK parliamentary agendas, has been the subject of official inquiries with the British government, but still no progress. This as activists seek a peaceful path to lasting reforms.
It's very unfortunate that what is called international community is headed by some who are the main reason for the problems in the world. The United States and Western Europe, who are backing the dictators rather than backing the people.
Activists argue the continuing atrocities committed against the Bahraini people can only happen with the consent of the international community, and are urging fresh action, not just words.
After over a decade of broken promises, false dawns, imprisonment, intimidation, torture, and even death, the brave freedom fighters for Bahrain have pledged to fight on to get Bahrain and its people the justice they're owed. Amina Taylor, London.
The central mosque of Kashmir's capital state, Srinagar, has stood for centuries as a pedestal of religious and political activities in this Muslim-majority region. Hundreds of thousands of Muslims from different parts of Kashmir would gather here on Fridays, filling lanes and roads to say prayers in this centuries-old mosque. But now, after India abrogated Kashmir's special status in August 2019, this 600-year-old mosque remains shuttered.
This is a place of worship. Why did they impose restrictions on our religious activities when there is no lockdown for other religious activities or social and political activities? Why here? COVID is just a pretext that the government is using.
The Indian authorities see the Grand Mosque as the epicenter for anti-India protests and clashes. For decades, authorities in Kashmir have struggled to contain the sentiments in this region claimed by both India and Pakistan, but ruled in parts. The mosque, with the capacity to hold 33,000 devotees, is surrounded by a wider market that is defunct following the closure.
Fridays or occasions like Eid were the days when we would earn sustenance. For the past 2.5 years, handling family and home affairs has been tough. If authorities continue to keep this mosque closed, our families would crumble and we will be pushed into poverty.
Though the religious freedom is enshrined in the Indian constitution, people in Indian-administered Kashmir say the continued closure of Kashmir's Grand Mosque belies India's claims of religious freedom, equality and justice in Kashmir. Shahanabad, Indian-administered Kashmir.
It was a night of happy tears and regret for Iranian cineasts and filmmakers. The closing ceremony of the 40th Fajr Film Festival saw the announcement of the best films on Friday. After 10 days of a tight competition, everybody now holds their breaths as the jury announces the winners. The award for Best Leading Actress went to Tanaz Tabatabai for her performance in Without Her.
It was hard, but we nailed it. I should thank every single one of the cast and crew. If it wasn't for their efforts, I would have not been standing here.
And acclaimed Iranian actor Amin Hayai nabbed the award for Best Leading Actor for starring in The Last Snow.
This is my second Simorgh Award. This time, too, I worked with crew members who put all their energy into the film. And this led me to win the award again.
A lineup of 22 films, mostly made by the new generation of Iranian filmmakers, competed for a Crystal Simorgh as the top prize of the festival. The Situation of Mehdi pocketed the awards in 5 categories, including Best Direction, Best Visual Effects, and Best Sound Mixing, as well as the Golden Simorgh Award for the top film of the festival. Directed by Hadi Hejazi Farr, the war drama documents 2 major operations Iran carried out during the 1980 to 1988 Iran-Iraq War. Laureates believe the cinematic event has played a major role in upgrading the Iranian cinema industry.
I'm so happy to be acknowledged in my first presence as a director in the festival. I should thank all of those who supported me. The festival encourages the filmmakers to try to excel, and this is what makes the entire film industry grow.
Fajr Film Festival is held every year on the anniversary of the victory of Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution. The 40th edition of the cinematic event kicked off on February the 1st and screened feature and short films as well as documentaries over the course of 10 days.
The 40th Fajr Film Festival rolled back the red carpet with smiles and tears. For sure, it was a memorable night for those who nabbed the Crystal Simorgh, as their films will definitely go down in the list of the blockbusters of Iranian flicks. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Painting pictures of a revolution that shook the world to its core more than 4 decades ago. Children born here, but staying connected to Iran.
I think the Islamic Revolution has brought a lot of joy to many people, and basically it shows that we are Muslims and we are proud of who we are.
The paintings are part of a ceremony at the Islamic Center of England, in the heart of London, on the 43rd anniversary of a day that changed the course of Iranian history.
Before Islamic Revolution in Iran, there was not such a good relationship, from the Pahlavi regime with a religion, and because it was based on a secular system.
Led from exile in France by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the uprising toppled a U.S.-backed despotic monarchy and replaced it with an Islamic republic, ushering in an era of political freedoms and independence from foreign influence. To the Shah's Western backers, the perceived loss of a modernized Iran under his rule to an Islamic Republic was a consequential blow to their interests in the region. What followed was 4 difficult decades that saw a devastating Western-backed war in the 1980s, an ongoing economic war, military threats, and relentless demonization.
The West hates Iran.
They surround it with military bases. They supplied bombs and ammunition and poison gas. The extraordinary thing, though, is that Iran is probably at a point where instead of being on the defensive, it may be able to go forward and give a lead to a world badly in need of a new lead.
To other non-Iranians, the revolution has qualities that makes it relevant to the world today.
For me, as a Muslim in the 21st century, it's important to try to find leadership that instills the concept of taqwa, that instills the concept of piety, and talks about the concept of unity.
For more than four decades now, Iran has defied many who had predicted the revolution's imminent collapse. At 43, these participants tell us it's a stable country in an unstable region, powerful militarily, and as united as ever against hegemonic powers. Saeed Hurriza, London.
France has totally rejected a legal request for the release of Europe's oldest political prisoner, Georges Ibrahim Abdallah, who is known as the Arab Nelson Mandela. In 1982, Israel had invaded Lebanon yet again. Abdullah's resistance group accepted responsibility for the deaths of an Israeli and an American agent in Paris, saying they were the legitimate acts of self-defense of a country under foreign invasion. Abdullah's trial was noted for its lack of proof, and his own lawyer later confessed to secretly working for the government. Ultimately, it seems that France has inaccurately classified Abdallah not as a soldier, but as a common criminal. There have been favorable court decisions for Abdallah over the decades, but governmental interference has not allowed them to be implemented or respected. If France refuses to let their courts release Abdallah, then it seems they are intent on forcing him to die in jail, and in a country which prides itself on having abolished the death penalty a few decades ago. Abdallah refuses to repent or to recant his support for Palestine, and many believe that's a primary reason why he hasn't been released.
George is a fighter. He'll have no problem with this latest injustice. After 37 years of harassment, bullying, and humiliation, he is well aware that the deck is stacked against him. George maintains a vast global correspondence despite his imprisonment, and he still lives for the movement of anti-imperialism, anti-Zionism, and leftist politics.
The fight for the liberation of George Abdallah has gone from total obscurity to becoming an international cause, with anti-French protests recently held in North Africa, Lebanon, and even Latin America. Demonstrators say that they and Abdallah's supporters worldwide will never stop fighting for his liberation from French injustice. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
It is the revolution that continues to reverberate around the globe. Iran's Islamic Revolution ushering in a new age by ousting the U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime. Father Frank Gelly, who became an ordained minister, recalls his initial reaction when news of the revolution broke.
At the time, I considered myself quite left-wing, so I enjoyed the idea there should be a revolution against the Shah. I considered the Shah a tyrant.
One of the most inspirational things about the Islamic Revolution for its many admirers is not just the impact that it's had inside of Iran, but it's the growing legacy that it continues to build globally. For political observers, Iran's stoic path proved an innovative and bold new model where alliances could be forged and solidarity fostered.
Because of its anti-imperialistic values, that's why Iran has good relations with lots of other countries around the world, Muslim and non-Muslim, that have also suffered colonialism and occupation. I mean, it could be Cuba, it could be Venezuela, many countries in Africa around the world who, you know, have a certain affinity with Iran because of that.
There's also another element to those who admire the aims and accomplishments of the revolution. As the revolution moves towards another remarkable milestone, the West still continues its opposition campaign despite a lack of success.
I can't think of too many examples of countries around the world that have withstood the barrage of war, sanctions, media hatred, internal subterfuge, you know, kind of instigated from outside, that Iran has. Yet they're still here. And they're not just surviving by the skin of their teeth. They're thriving as well. They have a strong military. They have strong regional allies. They have political influence, especially within their area in the Middle East. I think that it's widely recognized, even by haters of Iran, that Iran is one of the major regional players.
With its legacy still rippling across the globe, supporters of the Islamic Revolution internationally know they owe Iran and Iranians a great debt. Amina Taylor, London.
Iranians from different walks of life have marked the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Millions of Iranians were out on motorcycles, cars, and bicycles in the streets and squares all over the country due to coronavirus pandemic, waving flags of Iran and banners in support of their country.
I'm 15 years old. I'm here as a young adult to say that we don't care what the enemies are saying against the Islamic Revolution. We are here to show our support for our leader and our country.
I'm 43 years old as the Islamic Revolution. I'm here to voice my support for the Islamic establishment. When we see people are taking part in rallies across the country, it means that we have security and tranquility. Accordingly, we are here to honor the blood of our martyrs and celebrate our day of independence.
Speaking on the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi said the country's foreign policy relies on balance and progress hinges on unity and convergence, and Iran does not pin hope on the West.
I trust in God and I trust in people. Our foreign policy is based on balance, but the view towards the West has caused an imbalance. Our hopes are in God and our own regions, including provinces of Khuzestan, Khorasan, Azerbaijan, from the east to the west, north and south of the country. We have no hope in Vienna and New York.
In a statement at the end of the events, the demonstrators underlined the necessity of preserving national unity and avoiding any measure that would foment division and sedition in the country.
Analysts believe that after 43 years since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, and despite different forms of conspiracies against the Islamic Revolution, Iran has currently been turned into a beacon of hope for freedom-seeking and the oppressed nations of the world. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Qasim Ali Himani and Sheikh Qasim. Assalamu alaikum to both of you and welcome to the show.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, brother.
Assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about a big question, and that is the compatibility between religion or religious beliefs and science. As we know, most of the scientists are concerned with the objective findings. For example, through out the history, the objective sciences, which are done in laboratories or are done in the field of study or something like that. As we can find in the religious studies, you know, we are mainly concerned with the divinity or with the divine, the supernatural powers, with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and all of this. At the first glance, it might look that there is no compatibility between religious beliefs and science or scientific beliefs. The method is up in the minds of the people, especially of the 21st century, who are as you can see, busy with different materialistic things around. And the case is that they expect the science to answer all their questions in terms of their body and their mind, you know. And they do that. But when they get to the religion and religious beliefs, they say, This is something ancient. This is something archaic. We cannot, for example, expect a religious belief who was revealed, for example, at least 1,400 years ago to solve our problems today. What's your answer to that?
Actually, you know, I think the problem is even deeper than that. You know, nowadays we're encountering a new phenomenon called new atheism, or, you know, the scientific atheism. Unfortunately, this type of atheism, actually, we had the atheism throughout history, but that one, you know, the old one.